For several weeks now, we've been working our way through passages from Paul's letter to the Romans, which is basically serving as Paul's introduction of himself and his teachings to the Christian community in Rome while he's on his way there for the very first time. And he's laying out the gospel that he preaches and what he believes and the impact that the dying and rising of Jesus has. And so, like a couple of weeks ago, we dealt with the passage that was very instrumental in forming the church's teachings on original sin. Last week we had a passage talking about the impact of baptism. It is, what does the word baptism mean? If you literally translate the Greek word into English, it means to be immersed. And it's not just immersed into water, but being immersed into the dying, the burial of, and the rising of Jesus from the dead. So when you were baptized, what happened to you? You've been baptized, right? You were baptized into Jesus' death, his death to sin and death, and buried with him, and then while here on earth, starting to participate in and live in his rising from the dead to ultimately experience the fullness of it when Jesus comes again at the end of time and our mortal bodies are raised and reunited with our immortal souls. While we're still here, I guess there's something that still needs to go on, right? Right? Because, you know, one of the things that Paul brings up in last week's passage from Romans is that we're supposed to be dead to sin. Did you know that? Did you know that you were supposed to be dead to sin? In many places, that's not been taught very clearly or very well. In fact, it was not taught to us while I was in seminary in the 1980s. Yes, you become a member of the body of Christ, the church. Yes, you're participating in his dying and his rising, but that whole dead to sin thing seemed to have been left out somewhere along the way, and it's had an impact on the life of the church today because it goes farther than we think. It's developed into today's passage from Romans as well, where we're not supposed to live in slavery to the flesh, but in the freedom of the, hint, spirit, which we received at baptism, then was brought to a stronger level at confirmation, and then being nurtured with word and sacrament, especially the Eucharist. So we're supposed to be dead to sin. So what happened? What went wrong? Doesn't look like too many people are actually dead to sin today, does it? And there's an awful lot of sin going on around us and in us, right? Be honest, right? How many of us are not struggling with sin and the temptations that come along to trip us up and hurl us into it? What went wrong? Things that go on in history and in society and in culture have an impact on the faith life of the church. And there have been some very big ones starting out in the 19th century, the 1800s. Like, for an example, you've heard of a guy named Charles Darwin? What's Charles Darwin famous for? Theory of evolution. Was Charles Darwin a believer? Maybe earlier on in his life, he was sort of kind of, maybe a little bit kind of a believer. In fact, his father wanted him to go to med school, and he didn't like it too well, so he kind of dropped out. So instead, his father then sends him on to an Anglican church seminary, which he also drops out of because he didn't like it, and his faith was starting to die, and it died even further. There is a young guy, while he's in his teaching days, who writes to him and says, you know, I really need to know from you, do you believe in the New Testament? There's a letter that was sold on auction a couple of months ago, and in it, he very clearly states, "Dear sir, I am sorry to have to inform you that I do not believe in the Bible as a divine revelation, and therefore not in Jesus Christ as Son of God. Yours faithfully, Charles Darwin." And he goes on a little bit later to say he rejects the God of the Old Testament as well because he finds that God to be very vindictive, and so shouldn't put your faith in him. So with that is sitting at a root basis of his theory of evolution, what's missing from it? Remember, here's a guy who is now categorically stating he does not believe. What kind of an impact does that have on his theory of how all life began, and in particular, how we got to human life? There's no deity involved whatsoever. Remember, he is an atheist. He self-described, proclaimed atheist. God has nothing to do with the human race. And that has only gotten reinforced, especially in the way it's being taught in this day and age in our schools, especially public schools and secular universities. There's no mention of God having anything to do with the formation of the human race whatsoever, and what's being said instead is what makes a difference and what's having an impact on our actually having a realization that we're supposed to be dead to sin, and realizing that because of baptism we've been freed from slavery to sin. That was even in the opening prayer today. What do we believe as Catholics? Right out of the book of Genesis. Let us create man in our own image and likeness, and male and female, and he created him. All of the animals that swim in the sea or the water or fly through the air or walk and crawl, whatever, around the ground, act completely based on nothing more than instinct, something that's sort of pre-wired and programmed into their brains. And according to modern evolutionary theory, without God involvement in it anywhere, that's all we are. Everything is determined by instinct, so everything that we do in our heads is just natural. But then we know from our faith that when God created us in his image and likeness, that we were given something that goes above and beyond all the rest of the entirety of animal life. We were given an intellect and a will. Yes, they've been damaged by original sin, but we still have them, and God has provided what necessary to make up for what is lacking in our weakened intellect and will, so we can choose rightly what to do, what not to do, while we're here on earth during this life. But we've got this preponderance going on around us in society today, and its evidence is everywhere, that it's nothing more than instinct. There's no divine influence, there's no divinity in there anywhere, there's nothing else but just doing whatever comes naturally. And so we do just whatever. But then again, what does Paul teach us from this passage today about what our lives are supposed to be like? Not according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit of God, who comes to dwell with us in baptism and then brought to fulfillment in confirmation and then nurtured and strengthened in the rest of the sacraments, especially the Eucharist. So, let's flesh this out a little bit. When Paul says living in the flesh, what exactly does he mean? What is it to live in the flesh? You can find the answer, obviously it's going to be in the Catechism, but it's coming out of scripture passages from Romans, from the letter to the Galatians, to the Ephesians, from the Gospel of Matthew, the letter of John, and the Gospel of John. And he puts it out like this. The works of the flesh are evident. Sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. That's what Paul means by living in the flesh. But we're not supposed to live in the flesh, we're supposed to live in the Spirit. So, with all of that influence going on around us that is, you know, there's nothing behind human behavior other than just pure instinct, what do we do? What Paul is saying here sounds like it's the imposition of one incredibly impossible burden. Because if it's all just instinct and there's nothing we can do about it, then it winds up making human life look like some sort of a hopeless mess. Is there an answer? Is there an antidote to this? Instant replay, I'll try that again. Is there any kind of an antidote to this? Is it just a hopeless mess, or is there something to hope in? We're trying to get something out of you here. Is there something? Yeah, it was in the gospel passage. Those were the words of Jesus that Matthew has recorded for us in this passage today. And he puts it this way, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy burdened, and I'm going to make your burden even heavier and more burdensome." No, what did he say? "I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now, for those of you not familiar with farming, before the tractor age, what does it mean to take animals and yoke them together? It's a piece of wood that's carved out and strapped on so that two beasts of burden pull together on one load. So Jesus is inviting us, deliberately saying, come yoke yourself, join yourself, unite yourself to me. Why? What he's saying is, come and I will help you pull the load. And who do you think is stronger, us or Jesus? As struggling to get an answer out of that at 8 o'clock and 4:30. Who do you think is stronger, you or Jesus? Should be painfully obvious, right? But we keep forgetting that part. And we keep obstinately and foolishly trying to do it on our own and keep realizing the hard way, often, over and over again, that we can't. But he can. He makes the yoke and the burden easy because he's pulling the greater share of the weight, because his strength is infinite, inexhaustible, and cannot be overcome by anything. And I do mean by anything. So in him, if we keep ourselves united with him in faith, we will have all the help, strength, grace, guidance, wisdom we could ever possibly need, and more, so that we fulfill this challenge that our faith gives us of living in the Spirit instead of giving into and living in the flesh. The temptations will be there. Remember, Satan knows every one of your buttons to push, but every time you will be able to put their impact to death because you are joined to someone whose strength is greater than Satan and all the demons put together ever can be. You can easily get to the point where all of those temptations will be dead to you because you are conquering them in It is beyond possible to live in the Spirit and not give in to all of these temptations of the flesh. It is possible in him to live a faith that is radiant and glowing and attracts other people because they will see, yet, yes, there is hope. There is strength. There is the possibility of living a faith-filled life, even if all the rest of the world around us is going crazy. Because God himself has said, come to me. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. My yoke is easy. My burden is light because I'm bearing the far greater share of it for you.